I'm Carlos Virgen, and this is The Storyline, produced by The Day in New London, Connecticut. On Wednesday, December 20, we ran a story by Rick Koster about what was spelled out on the marquee of the Guard Art Center, which read in all capital letters, "Final appearance, transgender, fetus, vulnerable, diversity, science-based, evidence-based, and entitlement." It was a message in response to a story by the Washington Post about a list of words and phrases that the Department of Health and Human Services reportedly presented to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that should be avoided when preparing next year's budget. The story on theday.com garnered a very big response from our readers. At the time of this recording, it had 165 comments, plus many more on our Facebook page. The comments ranged from support for the Guard to outrage that the nonprofit organization would display what is perceived as a political message. Some readers also questioned whether or not the report of the banned words was accurate, some calling it fake news. Some readers pointed out to follow-up reports by other news organizations, such as PBS NewsHour and NPR, in which the director of the Department of Health and Human Services, who oversees the CDC, denied that there was a list of banned words. In a tweet, Dr. Brenda Fitzgerald said, quote, "I want to assure you that there are no banned words at CDC. We will continue to talk about our important public health programs. CDC has a long-standing history of making public health and budget decisions that are based on the best available science and data and for the benefit of all people. And we will continue to do so," she said. Another report by the New York Times confirmed that some CDC officials suggested that the proposal was, quote, "not so much a ban on words, but a recommendation to avoid some language to ease the path toward budget approval by Republicans." So while some officials at the CDC refute the characterization that they were given a list of words that should be banned, they do not refute the report that there was a suggestion that the avoidance of some language might make it more likely to get budget approval from Republicans. Back to the Guard marquee that has garnered so much local attention. Guard Executive Director Steve Siegel characterized it as a form of satire, saying, quote, "There's nothing incendiary or political about it. It's just words taken off of news feeds. It's a statement. If we were putting God Bless America on the marquee, people would react to. The message to me is that we are all highly attuned to visual signaling and we react. What I hope is that the message is a reminder that one of the great levelers in a democracy is levity."
The Gold Star Bridge, the southbound side of it in particular, has been on our radar for about 2 weeks now, ever since they switched the traffic from the right side of the bridge to the left side of the bridge. By the way, there are only three lanes open right now because they're doing a bridge rehabilitation project that's been going on since April. So it's been a little bit of a concern. It's been in the news, but this whole thing really came to a head yesterday when there was a morning rush hour crash between three vehicles. Some people got stuck in this and ended up with almost an hour longer than normal commute, which is insane when you think about just a couple miles of bridge. It got worse this morning because there was another crash near the same area of the same bridge during this construction project. The reports show, actually we went and looked at state police logs, the reports show there have actually been almost 10 such wrecks in the last just more than 10 days. So what we're seeing is a pattern here. A lot of these are happening in the right lane. A lot of it is people in the right lane of I-95 slowing down to let people from the Bridge Street ramp merge on, and then someone behind one of them not slowing down. Obviously problematic. So what is going to happen now? People have clearly failed to adjust as the DOT wished they would, is that the DOT has decided to just straight up close the Bridge Street ramp starting on Saturday. That's the 23rd. And what that'll look like, we're not totally sure. There are a couple concerns that it could impact local roads, but I did just get off the phone with the project manager for the DOT, and he said, you know, it's possible, of course, especially with EB out there, that there could be some type of an impact from this closure, but it's very much unlikely to be worse than what happens when one of these wrecks happens on I-95. So Keith Shoppy, that's the construction manager's name, he's talking a little bit about their decision to close the ramp, obviously in response to complaints about how short the Bridge Street merge was, and in response to some of the wrecks, in response to people's apparent non-adjustment to the ramp. And he added a point that I think is interesting, which is why not just close it right away? They needed a couple days to get the signage up. They needed a couple days to alert the employees of the companies that are most likely to be affected. They needed to coordinate with local police. But that said, within, you know, 3 days of making this announcement, they're going to have that ramp closed. Probably will be closed until Memorial Day. That's the next phase of the bridge project. So Keith said that from the complaints that he's gotten, way more people are ecstatic about the closure than are not. So we'll see what happens.
Partway through this week, I thought that I would be writing two stories about beloved businesses closing after having been open for a while. It turns out that only one is closing for good, so that was some good news. That was a bit of a plot twist, as I had called it. So John's Mystic River Tavern on Cottrell Street closed on Tuesday night after 50 years in operation. And then the other one is Monica State Street Diner had announced on Monday that it would be closing after 15 years on Friday. So I'd spoken with Monica, the owner, on Wednesday morning, and she was telling me, you know, about the history there, and they'd gone through a lot with having a fire back in 2013, and then they were closed for 7 months, and the community really rallied around them. But she said it's just tough, you know, bills are going up for electricity and, you know, food prices are going up and she's trying not to increase her prices and just customers aren't coming in like they used to. She said it's just tough if people are trying to save money. So she thought she was going to have to close or had announced that she was closing. But then later in the day on Wednesday, she called me and said she'd come to an agreement with Wings and Pies across the street to move in there and operate with them. So this all came together very quickly just over the course of a few days. And so they're still working out the details on that, but she said it will be breakfast as usual on January 1st and that she'll still be there and herself and the other six people who are working will still have their jobs at Wings and Pies. So, and I was seeing a bunch of really supportive comments on Facebook on Wednesday evening after Monica announced this deal, that people were excited that that this came about and that Monica's wouldn't be closing for good, and people saying, you know, this seems like a good idea. Unfortunately, John's did not have that resolution, and this was an instance where I thought, oh man, I wish I'd gone there sooner. So I swung by John's first on Sunday night just to talk to some patrons, and I was approaching some people, and then outside, there was one woman who was just really excited to talk to me, and you know, for a lot of people in Mystic, they think this is really the last neighborhood bar, the last locals bar, that Mystic has a lot of bars and restaurants that are geared towards tourism, and those are nice in their own right, but for some people, they really like that. You can go in and always run into people you know, there's a lot of regulars there. And one story that kept coming up was about how the owner, or the old owner, John Lowe, who died several years back, apparently got into this big spat with a Budweiser distributor. And depending on who you'll talk to, they've heard different stories about what the argument was regarding. But he, because of this spat with the distributor, he's like, I'm never going to distribute Budweiser in this beer, in this bar again. And Budweiser was never seen there anymore. And there was a sign that went up on the wall with a Budweiser can and a cross through it. The other thing people talk about a lot is that John Lowe just did not have any tolerance for cursing. So he had a swear jar. And so if you cursed, you'd put money in the swear jar, and he gave that money to the Jimmy Fund, which is a nonprofit supporting cancer research and treatment in Boston. And I think one woman I was talking to had told me that someone just comes in and just wanted to swear, so they just like dropped $5 in the jar and just go went off. So I went back there again on Monday night because John Francesconi, who is manager at Bank Square Books, had told me that one tradition he's been doing with other booksellers there the past few months is going to what he refers to as old-timey music night. So it's you have people playing banjo, fiddle, guitar, upright bass, violin. So when I was there was about 10 musicians gathered, and I just loved how informal and unpretentious it was. They're all just sitting on chairs in the corner playing, and you know, people were dancing around in circles and stomping on the ground and pounding their hands on the table and cheering, and people, obviously it was bittersweet that people were, you know, celebrating their favorite bar, but of course sad that it was going away. So it was very crowded there, and I really want to know where these musicians are going to play now, because it was just such a fun time, and I wish that had been a tradition I could have done on Monday nights when John's was open. And then Tuesday night, again, lots of people gathered there, and they were open a little bit past when the owner wanted to close, and until all the drinks were running out.
One of our photographers, Sarah Gordon, and I have been following around two Navy families while their husbands are deployed on one of the submarines that's based at the base in Groton. Basically, the idea came about, we felt we covered a lot of the homecomings, you know, a lot of the aspects of, you know, submarine construction, and, you know, I spent 2 days on a submarine myself, but we really haven't told the story of what happens, sort of how life at home goes on without these sailors. And a lot of cases I had heard anecdotally at the homecomings and other places how these women had come to really rely on each other. You know, it could be something as simple as somebody coming over and watching the kids so that the woman could shower and, you know, even get ready for something, or the homecoming even. So we felt like we really wanted to tell that story. So we're following them for a couple of months until the submarine comes back. I can't talk too much about, I can't say the name of the submarine or talk at all in any detail about when it's getting back, but we felt it was worth it to spend some time. We try to spend at least one day a week with them, or try to see them at least once a week, spend a couple of hours with them. You know, we've been there in the morning while they're getting the kids ready for school. We've hung out with them when they've picked the kids up from the bus. We were there for Thanksgiving. So we're just trying to sort of capture what their life is like. The plan is to release probably it will be a few different stories, maybe a series of stories that'll come out in the spring, early in the spring. And ideally, we'd like to also get the perspective of the husbands coming back and integrating back into the family, because that's also something I've heard is that, you know, they've been living this, you know, very work-intensive life and very unique life for, you know, 6-7 months at a time. And so it takes them a while to get back, you know, into the swing of things. And, you know, their spouse was maybe taking care of the bills and, you know, they're handling things, you know, and so the husbands sort of have to come back into that and find their way and sort of get acclimated again. So we'd like to try to get that perspective in as well. But yeah, it should be a really, really great visual and longer piece story.
Back in October, the town of Ledyard passed a trash ordinance that essentially removed municipal trash pickup from mobile home parks and mobile home residents. The move was expected to save $20,000 to $24,000. The problem was that obviously residents or mobile home residents were really, really upset because you're almost exclusively removing one service that you give to all the residents and homeowners in town. The move kind of went under the radar. Most of the park operators and residents didn't really know what happened until they got a mail notice telling them that, hey, we're no longer picking up your trash. So last week there was a town council meeting where a lot of people were given the opportunity to voice their complaints. It's unclear whether that's going to change anything on the town council side or whether they're going to revise the ordinance. One big question at the heart of it is who becomes responsible for trash pickup in these communities now. State statute for mobile home parks says that operators have to arrange pickup, but that doesn't necessarily mean, or at least they're arguing, that you have to pay for it. So it's really kind of this lingering question that hasn't quite gotten resolved, and there's questions about whether park operators will make a legal challenge to the ordinance if they try to stick by it. We got a tip telling us, kind of outlining, hey, it was one park operator who has a very, very small park, only three tenants. And he was saying, hey, they passed this ordinance and it changed things. And his concern was more the equity of it. That was kind of his argument that, hey, they pay tax dollars. Mobile home owners pay property taxes just like everyone else. They're paying for this service. They're not going to receive it. The other problem that a lot of park operators found, including himself, was the question of where am I going to get service then? A lot of companies don't want to come into Ledyard just to pick up, you know, 200 residents' trash. It's not exactly the most profitable thing, so they have to charge them a really high rate, which ultimately would trickle down to homeowners.
We heard from reporters Lindsay Boyle, Erica Moser, Julia Bergman, and Charlie Clark.